We've talked quite a bit about affliction and about suffering in these past few stanzas of Psalm 119. And as a recommendation, for those who are going through a period of difficult trial or suffering, one thing I would strongly encourage a believer to do is to pick up the stories of pioneer missionaries and read them. It will be a great encouragement to you and a great help. Because as you read the stories of some of the great missionary pioneers of the past, you'll find, and I think you'll find either that your challenges are very, very small when compared to the pain and suffering that these men and women faced, or at least you will, at the very least, you will find companions, those who have suffered as you have. Just take as one example Adoniram Judson, a name you may know. He was the man who brought the gospel to Burma. In 1813, he landed with a great vision to reach that country for Christ and to proclaim the gospel, to translate the scriptures. And he did all of that despite incredible, incredible hardship. First of all, when Adoniram Judson landed, it took years and years for him to really get settled. There wasn't a single convert for the first 6 years of his ministry there. Not only that, in the 1820s, there was a war between England and Burma that started. And Adoniram Judson was arrested, even though he was an American, as a spy. All foreigners were. And so he was taken the prisoner as a spy. And every night, he would be tied up by his ankles, lifted up and suspended upside down all night long. He endured vicious beatings. For 17 months, he languished in prison. Not only that, his wife and newborn daughter were struggling themselves. His wife, Anne, would walk 2 miles every day to the prison to bring food to her husband and to beg for his release. Finally, after 17 months, he was released, and things seemed to be looking up until Anne's health broke. She had smallpox. She died shortly after. Then 6 months after she died, Judson's young daughter, Maria, also died. It sent him spiraling into a bitter darkness. Judson cut off everyone from his life. In fact, he left his home, went out into the jungle, and built a hut where he would live in isolation. Next to his hut, he dug a grave for himself, feeling that his life was pretty much over. It was the deepest, darkest time of his life. He wrote a letter to a family member back in the States during this period, and here's what he writes in that letter. He says, "God to me is the great unknown. I believe in him, but I find him not." Thankfully, the darkness did eventually lift from Judson's life, and he remained in Burma for 37 years, laboring for Christ. But this was his, without doubt, lowest, darkest moment. Notice what he says. He says, "Even though God feels 1,000 miles away, even though I don't sense his presence with me, I still believe. He's the great unknown. And though I find him not, I believe in him." And I think that quote is a good jumping off point for our study of Psalm 119, verses 81 to 88. Because this represents the low point in the psalm. Yes, we've been talking about struggles and trials and enemies that he has, but now we've hit rock bottom. This is where it gets bleak. Charles Spurgeon referred to this section of the psalm as the midnight of the psalm. That's a good way to think of it. We've reached midnight, the darkest point. And he is probably feeling a bit like Adoniram Judson. Also, you'll note that this is the 11th stanza in this extended poem, which means we're exactly halfway. There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, each section connected to a Hebrew letter. So this is exactly halfway point, and it's also the lowest point for the psalmist. He's reached a place of desperation where there seems to be no light coming in. Now, one of the things that we can love about this psalm, and all the psalms, frankly, is that they deal so honestly with lament and with suffering and grief. In fact, so much so that sometimes it makes us a little uncomfortable with how forthright the psalmist is about expressing his own heartache. Not only that, we also could look at this and wonder to ourselves, man, this trial just goes on and on. I mean, we've been talking, the last two stanzas have been all about affliction. And you maybe even came in this morning thinking, I wonder if Reed's going to talk about affliction again. Well, yes, we are. And I think there's a lesson in this. And that is, usually the most difficult trials in life are not a flash in the pan. It's not like they happen and then a day later they're gone. The hardest things you and I face are ones that may go on for years, may go on for a lifetime. And what do we do? What if we're at that low point? Well, the answer really is hang on. Hang on. Keep trusting. Keep believing. Keep following. Keep praying. And that's really what this section of Psalm 119 is about. Keeping on, even when you're at that darkest, lowest point. We could say it like this. Even in the mid the confusion and suffering of life, don't turn away from God or His Word. Even amid suffering and confusion, don't turn away from God and His Word. That is the temptation. In fact, many probably would look at the psalmist here and say, I don't know why he doesn't just toss it all in, quit, sink into utter despair. Maybe that's what Job's friends were thinking too. Why doesn't he just quit? But the answer is, even when trials and afflictions wax long, they give us a chance to continually put our trust in God, to keep holding on to Him when we have nothing else. I want to draw this out of the psalm and help you to see it by giving three directives. Three directives. These are all in your notes, so you can fill them in if you like. The first is, when help doesn't come, keep hoping. When help doesn't come, keep hoping. Look at verse 81 and 82. It says, my soul longs for your salvation. I hope in your word. My eyes long for your promise. I ask, when will you comfort me? You'll notice, by the way, a couple of things here in these two verses. You'll notice a parallel, right? He says, my soul and then my eyes. It's kind of the same, almost a repetition of these two thoughts. Also, if you're in the habit of underlining in your Bible, you might underline longs, or faints, or whatever your version might say, in verse 81, and then my eyes long, verse 82, it's the same word. Same word. He is longing for, waiting for, holding on to the hope that there's salvation coming. You know, it's been said that a person can live, 40, 50 days without food. You can live maybe up to 3 days without water. You can live maybe 5 minutes without oxygen, but you can't really live a minute without hope in life. We've probably all seen that, where someone who just gives up hope in life dies soon after. And we've also seen the opposite too, where someone who should have died has hope and they hold on longer than any of us would expect. See, hope is essential. And the psalmist is going through this period of extended grief and affliction. And he's looking and waiting for the Lord to rescue him. Let's pick it up in verse 81. He says, my soul, so the very depths of his being, longs for your salvation. The word long here means to be enduring to the point of exhaustion. Enduring to the point of exhaustion. Hence, fainting is one way to possibly translate it. So waiting on the Lord can be exhausting. He says, I'm almost at my wit's end here, hoping and waiting for your salvation. And I think salvation here is not necessarily, you know, being saved from sin, but being saved from this deep, dark pit that he's in, this cloud of grief that hangs over him. He says, my soul is fainting. I'm collapsing in exhaustion, waiting for this salvation to come. Notice what he says in the very next verse. He says, my eyes, same word, long for your promise. Now, when the word fainting or collapsing in exhaustion is applied to the eyes, it might be better to translate it straining. My eyes are straining. He's looking. And all he sees is pitch black. And he's straining his eyes, trying to see even a glimmer of hope. So he asks the question, verse 82, I ask, when will you comfort me? When will you comfort me? This is the question that we ask when we are in a painful circumstance like he is, when we are at midnight hour. And you can hear the pain of this cry, can't you? When will you comfort me? When will you comfort me? That's what he wants. By the way, there are throughout this section, there are little hints that show us that the psalmist, even though he is at his lowest point, he has not given up his faith. Here's a good example. You notice the question he asks, when will you comfort me? He's not asking, how will you comfort me? He's not asking if you will comfort me. He seems to believe that God's comfort is coming. He's just saying, when? I've waited a long time. And it seems like help isn't coming. What do I do? When will you comfort me? But then he uses an illustration for this. Verse 83, he says, for I have become like a wineskin in the smoke, yet I have not forgotten your statutes. By the way, there's the statement of faith, isn't there? Even though all of this, even though I'm waiting long and I'm fainting from waiting, my eyes are straining, even though I'm at the end of my rope, I have not forgotten your statutes. I've not forgotten your word. I'm holding on to it. So he doesn't turn away. But he uses this illustration in verse 83. He says, I'm like a wineskin in smoke. Now, this requires a little bit of explanation. What does he mean? Well, in ancient times, if you were carrying liquid, water, wine, whatever you were carrying, you had two options. You could carry it in a clay jar, which would be large, bulky, and heavy, or you could carry it in a wineskin, which was literally animal skin sewn together into a little leather bag, essentially. So you can see a picture there of what an ancient wineskin would look like. And it, as it's made out of leather, it's kind of a skin bag. So what happens, at least according to this illustration here, a merchant, for instance, is traveling through the desert, and he has water in this skin bag, and he sets up camp for the night. And what he does is, in the camp, he hangs up his wineskin somewhere in the camp. And in this case, he hangs it up a little bit too close to the fire. And he says, I'm like a wineskin in the smoke. Now, what happens when the heat from the fire and all the smoke goes up into that leather bag, especially assuming it's empty? Well, it starts to dry out the bag, and it starts to crack, and it starts to blacken, and it starts to wrinkle. And essentially, that's what the psalmist is saying here about himself. He's saying, you know, I'm withered. My eyes are sunken in. My cheeks are, too. My bones are showing through my skin. I'm at the end of what I can endure. I'm like a wineskin left in the smoke. But here's the thing. What would cause all that damage to the wineskin? You would have to leave it there for some period of time. So I think what he's saying is, I feel like a wineskin in the smoke, like somebody just left me here and they never came to get me. I've been forgotten. I've been left to languish in this condition. And this is the moment when people would say, you know, God, you've forgotten me. I'm through. I'm done. And just turn their back on all of it. But not the psalmist. He doesn't turn away from God. He keeps hoping. Go back to verse 81. My soul longs for your salvation. I hope in your word. By the way, to translate that, I wait for your word. I'm going to keep on waiting. It's long. It's painful. It seems like help isn't coming, but I'm going to keep hoping. Hope is what keeps us going. You have this languishing soul here in Psalm 119, but he continues to hope in his God's word. He hasn't cast his Bible aside. Instead, he has cast himself onto the Bible. He's trusting in the word. Go down to verse 83. He says, even though he's like a wineskin in the smoke, yet I have not forgotten your statutes. I'm still holding on to the truth you've given. Everything else is shifting sand, but I'm grasping to your word. When you are at that low point, and maybe you've been there. Maybe you've been there multiple times. When you're at that low point and it seems like nothing is right. You know, if you've lost someone in your life, had someone die suddenly and unexpectedly, you know what it's like to have that fog around your life where just nothing makes sense. Like you forget to eat because you're just in this cloud. I think that's what the psalmist feels like. He's in the cloud of affliction. Yet he says, I'm still going to grasp on to God's word. I'm going to keep hoping. And that's what we must do. We got to keep hoping, even when it seems like help is not coming. Even when we're all alone. Even when help is delayed and suffering continues long, keep hoping. I read a couple of paragraphs this week from the book Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. You probably have heard of him before. He was a survivor of the Holocaust, a Jew that was transferred around in several Nazi concentration camps. But he talks in this book about man's search for meaning, and he tells about the importance of hope. At one point, he tells the story of another prisoner in the concentration camp who had a dream. And in his dream, he imagined and saw that they were going to be liberated, that the camp was going to be freed, and they were all going to go home. And so Frankl asked this other prisoner, well, did the dream tell you when this was going to happen? He said, yes, I heard a date, March 30th. Well, the man was very excited. It gave him a little boost in his steps, but pretty soon it was March 25th, 26th, 27th, and closer it came. And then on March 30th, liberation didn't come. And Frankl says that the man became ill that day and within several days died because he just lost all hope. The one thing he had been clinging to was gone now. Here's what he says in the book. The ultimate cause of my friend's death was that the expected liberation did not come, and he was severely disappointed. His faith in the future and his will to live had paralyzed his body, and he fell victim to illness. Here's what he goes on to say in the book. He went on to say that those who lost hope lost their spiritual hold. See, that is what you and I need when we go through this dark midnight hour, is a spiritual hold on hope. Secondly, not only do we keep hoping, when enemies befall you, keep praying. When enemies befall you, keep praying. Look at verse 84. How long must your servant endure? When will you judge those who persecute me? The insolent have dug pitfalls for me. They do not live according to your law. So the constant threat that we have seen throughout this entire, the last 10 stanzas, is these enemies that have been attacking the psalmist. And so he asks a question, another question. We've already had the question, when will you comfort me? Now he says, how long must your servant endure? Really, it's how long are my days? The days of his affliction are long, and he's wondering, how much longer can I take this? Kind of sounds like Adoniram Judson, right? It sounds like he's dug a grave next to his hut. I can't go on much longer. But then he specifically says, and by the way, when he says, how long must your servant endure, that is applied here specifically to the attacks of his enemies. But that's a question we could ask, not just when we have enemies befall us, right? Whenever we're going to the doctor week after week and the tests keep coming back and there's more questions and more tests, we might ask the same question, how long can we endure? But then he specifically says in the next statement, when will you judge those who persecute me? So obviously his affliction here is the persecution, the hardship, the harm that's coming to him from other people. Basically, this is the same question that we read in Revelation 6 when the tribulation saints, the spirits of the saints are beneath the altar and they say, how long, O Lord, until you judge the world? That's what he's asking here. How long until justice is done? When will you judge those who persecute me? And then he describes what they're doing. Verse 85, the insolent. By the way, I've mentioned that affliction has tied together these last three stanzas, but you'll also notice that the word insolent appears in each of them too. All the way back in verse 69, verse 78, verse 85. the insolent, the arrogant. Those who spurn God's ways make life difficult for our author. They're persecuting him. It says here that they're digging pits for me. Now, this was a snare. You dig a pit to try and catch an animal. I remember watching the old Swiss Family Robinson, you know, where the pirates come to attack the family, and they have dug all these pits, and they have the tiger pit and all that. You know, that's kind of the idea. You dig a pit, the animal comes along, falls in, and you've trapped it. And so what he's saying is they've dug pits, they've created traps for me. They're trying to snare me. They're trying to trip me up, trying to do harm to me. And this idea of digging traps or pits for people is all over in the Psalms as a way of expressing how they manipulate and how they do harm to others. And here's the thing I've noticed. This doesn't apply just to enemies like we see in the text here. But probably the most intense suffering that you will ever experience in life is going to be because of people. Now, yes, I mean, health, natural disasters, all of that can take a toll. But honestly, the most difficult things we face are usually have to do with relationships. You know, even a person who's been through really painful physical suffering may still say, the worst point of my life was when I went through that terrible divorce. Or when, you know, I dealt with this out-of-control child. Or whenever I was betrayed by someone I trusted. Or when someone hated me for no apparent reason. They just wanted to take out their anger on me. Those are the things that hurt most. Yeah, we can push through some of the physical suffering, but whenever it's people we love and people we know who mistreat us and abuse us, that's where intense suffering comes in. How do they persecute him? He says here, they tell lies. Even though they don't live according to your law, he says in verse 86, your commandments are sure, they persecute me with falsehood. Or maybe it could be they falsely persecute me, that, you know, in other words, without cause, without justification or reason. But it seems that they're using lies. They're telling lies about him and dragging him through the mud. Nevertheless, verse 86, all your commandments are sure. They're faithful. And then he says, verse 86, last two words, help me. That's the prayer. That's the request. Lord, help me. And sometimes it's all you can do when life is this, when you're at that midnight hour, is all you can do is just say, help me. I remember there was a gentleman who went to my church when I was growing up. He was a Marine pilot in World War II. And he was out in the Pacific, and for a period of time, he was a test pilot. So they would test out the aircraft. And he was basically trying to solve a problem. Number of planes, whenever they would dive bomb, would crash straight into the ground. You couldn't pull them up. So he said, I'm going to try and solve this. I'm going to try and figure out how to break the dive. So he said he took his plane up to 30,000 feet and then put it in a dive. And basically everything locked up. He was heading 700 miles an hour at the sea floor. And as that was happening, both wings of the plane were ripped off. And you know, this is before like high-tech ejection seats and all that stuff. He had a parachute, but he was able to rip the canopy off the plane and pull out. And he said that was the shortest prayer he ever prayed in his life. Lord, help me get out of this plane. And sometimes, you know, we're probably not in a plane that's headed straight to the Pacific Ocean, but sometimes it may feel like you're in a plane headed straight for the Pacific Ocean. Life is in a nosedive, and you say, I don't even know what to pray or how to pray. How about help me? It's like the prayer that Peter prayed whenever he was sinking into the Sea of Galilee. He said, Lord, save me. Not a complex prayer. But you'll notice they keep praying. Even when things are dark, even when enemies befall you, don't give up. Don't say, well, God, you know, God, I gave him a chance and he didn't come through. Keep praying. Heard a story from Billy Graham. A woman reached out to him and said, I've been praying for my husband for 10 years to come to know the Lord, and he's no closer now than he ever was. And Billy Graham said, well, my recommendation for you would be to keep praying. And then a year later, she wrote to him and said, I prayed and prayed just like you said, and the 11th year, he came to know Christ. It's like, well, what if she had given up after year 10? Keep praying. Even if things are not turning out, even if enemies surround you, keep praying. And then lastly, when life is unbearable, keep believing. Keep believing. One author states it like this. No matter what precautions we take, no matter how well we have put together a good life, no matter how hard we have worked to be healthy, wealthy, comfortable with friends and family, successful in our career, something will inevitably ruin it. So even if you've been eating the cleanest, healthiest diet you can manage, there still may be problems that come up in your body. Even though you may cultivate a great relationship with people around you, there are still people who may come along and hate you without cause. Something's going to ruin it because suffering's a part of life. Here's the question. What about when life becomes unbearable, though? Like when it's just at its absolute worst. And that's what the psalmist is saying here in verse 87. He says, they have almost made an end of me on earth. In other words, I'm almost done for. Like I came very close to the gates of death. They almost made an end of me on earth. This is his darkest moment. This is when life is unbearable. His heart is breaking. The night has never been darker. The answer, keep believing. By the way, remember I said there's little glimmers of hope in this section? You notice he says, they almost made an end of me on earth. Why include the words on earth? I kind of wonder if it's not a little bit of comfort here. Even through the despair, he says, they can destroy the body, but they can't destroy the spirit. They can't destroy the soul. They can make an end of me on earth, but my life is secure in God. But what he's saying here in verse 87 is, they almost made an end of me on earth. I couldn't take it anymore. But he doesn't say that. He doesn't say, I gave up. You know, some people, whenever they reach that pit of despair, think that the only option is to take their own life. And sadly, every 11 minutes in the United States, someone takes their own life. I don't know all the reasons, but at least in a number of them, it's because you reach a point of despair where it seems like there's no other option. This is all I can do. Life is just unbearable. Well, when it's unbearable, keep believing God's promises. Notice that's what the psalmist does. He says, they almost made an end of me, but I have not forsaken your precepts. I'm still holding on. I'm holding on by a thread, but praise God, that thread is God's word. They almost made an end of me, but I'm holding on to your truth. Then he says in verse 88, in your steadfast love, give me life. He feels like his life is almost over. Just like Adoniram Judson with his pit dug, he says, my life's almost over. Revive me. Give me life. Help me keep going. This according to your steadfast love. And there again is a glimmer of hope. That even though things are dark and even though he's waited long, God is still love. In your steadfast love, revive me. Give me life. He's still trusting. He's still believing. And the reason he wants life is so that I can keep your testimonies. He wants to live that word. You notice, by the way, twice in this section, verse 83 and verse 87, both say, I have not forgotten your statutes. I have not forsaken your precepts. He's holding on. He's believing God's truth, even when everything in his life screams otherwise. Don't give up. Even when your eyes are weary of searching the scriptures, keep at it. Keep trusting the Lord, even in the dark valley. It's only by not giving up on God that we endure through trials. Keep believing. Believe God's promises. One of the greatest promises we have in the Word is Romans 8:28, right? That all things work together for good to those who are called according to his purpose. So God is at work to do good, even through bad, even through the really hard, painful stuff. God is working to do good. Now, that was Romans 8:28 was written 1,000 years after Psalm 119, but I think the two truths of that verse and this passage merge pretty seamlessly. When life is unbearable, keep believing. I heard a story once of a seminary professor named E.C. Caldwell. He was lecturing on the book of Romans one day in his class, and he ended the lecture by saying, "Tomorrow we're going to be teaching on Romans 8. So tonight, as you study, pay special attention to verse 28. Notice that this verse, what this verse truly says and what it doesn't say. One final word before I dismiss you. Whatever happens in all the years to come, remember, Romans 8:28 will always hold true. Romans 8:28 will always hold true," he told his students. Well, Caldwell left the campus that day to head home, and he picked up his wife, and their car was struck by a train. Caldwell's wife was killed instantly. He was paralyzed permanently. He was in the hospital for months and months. And eventually, he came back to that class, the class that he had previously dismissed by saying, Romans 8:28 always holds true. And so every student in the class was looking at him, wondering what he was going to say after losing his wife and his mobility in this terrible accident. He came into class, and the room fell silent, and he said, Romans 8:28 still holds true. One day we shall see God's good even in this. See, when life is unbearable, and those are pretty unbearable circumstances, keep believing. Keep believing. Again, this section, verses 81 to 88, tells us to hold on, to keep pressing on, even when life is at its darkest. And the good news is, when we move on from here in our study of Psalm 119, things do get better. The light returns. The dawn comes. But every person here sooner or later is going to reach that midnight hour. And it's going to feel like things are closing in on you and you don't know what to do. And the temptation is to despair, to give up. But that's when we need to cling to faith like never before, because the dark night tests our grip. Will we forsake God and his word, or will we cling to him? I want to close with a true story. This is told by John Green. Maybe you are familiar with him. He's famous for writing young adult novels like The Fault in Our Stars and Looking for Alaska. But as a young man, when he was 20 years old, he was working at the Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, actually. And he was a intern chaplain for the hospital. His plan was to go on and to go into ministry and be ordained. But he was a student chaplain at the hospital. Well, one night, his pager lit up. You know, this was a number of years ago. He had a pager. Lit up, and he learned that there was a child coming into the hospital with severe burns. And he goes down, and there's a 3-year-old boy who was caught in a brush fire and burned head to toe. And he said it was terrible. The child was screaming in agony. There was chaos everywhere. Even the doctors seemed like this was a desperate moment. And one of the things he was told was, here, take the parents, get them out of here. And, of course, they are absolutely distraught. So he takes them up to this family room, no windows, and he sits across from this family. And here he is, 20 years old, doesn't know what to say to this grieving couple. And they're sitting on opposite sides of the couch. And he notes that during his training, they had specifically said, if a child dies, there's a very high chance that divorce will follow. And so he's seeing these parents, you know, already seem to be putting distance between one another. And so he kind of meekly offers to pray with them. And he asked, do you want to pray? And the woman shook her head no. He said even the doctors were breaking down in tears. The young boy's pediatrician showed up, and he said, I've never seen a doctor so shook. Well, later that day, he was relieved, and he said that was a moment that shook his faith. And he knew his plans to be ordained were over. And here's what he said years later. He said, I couldn't see God within these experiences. I just couldn't. And I thought, you know, how can you do this as a job? If part of you is sitting there thinking, the God I am calling to be present in this moment, I don't feel he's present. So John had a simple intuition that night. God was not there. Perhaps God did not exist at all. He stopped going to church. He stopped praying. Well, fast forward some 20 years. He's become a successful author, but that event stuck with him. So John Green, years later, Googled the name. He remembered the name of this family and this child named Nick. And he had assumed that the child had died, but he just kind of wondered what happened. Well, he typed it into the search engine. He found out Nick lived. He survived this ordeal. So John Green got in touch with him. And here's the curious thing, is that the event, the suffering of a child that had caused John Green to turn away from the faith that he professed and to, you know, doubt God, that same incident, this young boy Nick and his family had found the Lord. Family had invited them to church. Here he is burned. And, of course, he had lots of complications. He had been in and out of the hospital many, many times. But he and his family had grown stronger in their faith. So here's one event, two responses. One says, I don't see God in this. How could a loving God? And the other says, we're going to keep on trusting. And maybe someday John Green will find the peace that passes understanding. I don't know. But how do we respond when we reach that moment? And everyone would acknowledge that for Nick's family, that was the darkest night of their lives. But they turned to the Lord, not away. When you reach that point, keep hoping, keep praying, keep believing.